This is Audible.
Juneteenth Audiobooks and Time Warner Audiobooks present Ernest Gaines, A Lesson Before Dying. Read by Lionel Mark Smith with Roger Genvere Smith.
I was not there, yet I was there. No, I did not go to the trial. I did not hear the verdict because I knew all the time what it would be. Still, I was there. I was there as much as anyone else was there. Either I sat behind my aunt and his godmother, or I sat beside them. Both are very large women, but his godmother is larger. She is of average height, 5'4", 5'5", but weighs nearly 200 pounds. Once she and my aunt had found their places, two rows behind the table where he sat with his court-appointed attorney, she never got up once to get water or go to the bathroom down in the basement. She just sat there, staring at the boy's clean-cropped head where he sat at the front table with his lawyer. Even after he had gone to await the juror's verdict, her eyes remained in that one direction. She heard nothing said in the courtroom. Not by the prosecutor, not by the defense attorney, not by my aunt. Oh, yes, she did hear one word for sure, hog. She knew as well as we all knew what the outcome would be. A white man had been killed during a robbery, and though two of the robbers had been killed on the spot, one had been captured, and he, too, would have to die. Though he told them, no, he had nothing to do with it and that he was on his way to the White Rabbit Bar and Lounge when Brother and Bear drove up beside him and offered him a ride. After he got into the car, they asked him if he had any money. When he told them he didn't have a solitary dime, it was then that Brother and Bear started talking credit, saying that old Gropey should not mind crediting them a pint, since he knew them well and he knew that the grinding season was coming soon, and that they would be able to pay him back then. The store was empty, except for the old storekeeper, Alcee Gropey, who sat on a stool behind the counter. He spoke first. He asked Jefferson about his godmother. Jefferson told him his Nan-Nan was all right. Old Gropey nodded his head. "You tell her for me, I say hello," he told Jefferson. He looked at Brother and Bear, but he didn't like them. He didn't trust them. Jefferson could see that in his face. "Do for you, boys?" he asked. "A bottle of that apple white there, Mr. Gropey," Bear said. Old Gropey got the bottle off the shelf, but he did not set it on the counter. He could see that the boys had already been drinking, and he became suspicious. "You boys got money?" he asked. Brother and Bear spread out all the money they had in their pockets on top of the counter. Old Gropey counted it with his eyes. "That's not enough," he said. "Come on now, Mr. Gropey," they pleaded with him. "You know you're going to get your money soon as grinding start." "No," he said. "Money is slack everywhere. You bring the money, you get your wine." He turned to put the bottle back on the shelf. One of the boys, the one called Bear, started around the counter. "You stop there," Gropey told him. "Go back." Bear had been drinking and his eyes were glossy. He walked unsteadily, grinning all the time as he continued around the counter. "Go back," Gropey told him. "I mean, the last time now. Go back." Bear continued. Gropey moved quickly toward the cash register where he withdrew a revolver and started shooting. Soon there was shooting from another direction. When it was quiet again, Bear, Gropey, and Brother were all down on the floor, and only Jefferson was standing. He wanted to run, but he couldn't run. He couldn't even think. He didn't know where he was. He didn't know how he had gotten there. He couldn't remember ever getting into the car. He couldn't remember a thing he had done all day. He heard a voice calling. He thought the voice was coming from the liquor shelves. Then he realized that old Gropey was not dead, and that it was he who was calling. He made himself go to the end of the counter. he had to look across bare to see the storekeeper. Both lay between the counter and shelves of alcohol. Several bottles had been broken, and alcohol and blood covered their bodies as well as the floor. He stood there gaping at the old man, slumped against the bottom shelf of gallons and half gallons of wine. He didn't know whether he should go to him or whether he should run out of there. The old man continued to call. Boy. 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 Jefferson became frightened. The old man was still alive. He had seen him. He would tell on him. Now he started babbling.
It wasn't me. It wasn't me, Mr. Gropey. It was Brother and Bear. Brother shot you. It wasn't me. They made me come with them. You got to tell the law then, Mr. Gropey. You hear me, Mr. Gropey?
But he was talking to a dead man. Still, he did not run. He didn't know what to do. Again, he couldn't remember how he had gotten there. He didn't know whether he had come there with Brother and Bear or whether he had walked in and seen all this after it happened. He looked from one dead body to the other. He didn't know whether he should call someone on the telephone or run. He had never dialed a telephone in his life, but he had seen other people use them. He didn't know what to do. He was standing by the liquor shelf, and suddenly he realized he needed a drink and needed it badly. He snatched a bottle off the shelf, wrung off the cap, and turned up the bottle all in one continuous motion. The whiskey burned him like fire. His chest, his belly, even his nostrils. His eyes watered. He shook his head to clear his mind. Now he began to realize where he was. Now he knew he had to get out of there. He turned. He saw the money in the cash register under the little wire clamps. He knew taking money was wrong. His Nan-Nan had told him never to steal. He didn't want to steal, but he didn't have a solitary dime in his pocket. And nobody was around, so who could say he stole it? Surely not one of the dead men. He was halfway across the room, the money stuffed inside his jacket pocket, the half bottle of whiskey clutched in his hand when two white men walked into the store. That was his story. The prosecutor's story was different. The prosecutor argued that Jefferson and the other two had gone there with the full intention of robbing the old man and then killing him so that he could not identify them. When the old man and the other two robbers were all dead, this one, it proved the kind of animal he really was, stuffed the money into his pockets and celebrated the event by drinking over the still bleeding bodies. The defense argued that Jefferson was innocent of all charges except being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Gentlemen of the jury, do you see a man sitting here? I ask you, I implore you, look carefully. Do you see a man sitting here? Look at the shape of his skull. This face as flat as the palm of my hand. Look deeply into those eyes. Do you see a modicum of intelligence? Do you see anyone here who could plan a murder, a robbery, can plan anything? A cornered animal to strike quickly out of fear, a trait inherited from his ancestors in the deepest jungle of blackest Africa. Yes, yes, that he can do. But to plan? No, gentlemen, this skull here holds no plans. What you see here is a thing that acts on command. A thing to hold the handle of a plow, a thing to load your bales of cotton, a thing to dig your ditches, to chop your wood, to pull your corn. Gentlemen of the jury, be merciful. For God's sake, be merciful. He is innocent of all charges brought against him. But let us say he was not. Let us for one moment say he was not. What justice would there be to take this life? Justice, gentlemen? Why, I would just as soon put a hog in the electric chair as this. The jury retired and returned a verdict after lunch. Guilty of robbery and murder in the first degree. The judge commended the 12 white men for reaching a quick and just verdict. 10 o'clock on Monday, Miss Emma and my aunt sat in the same seats they had occupied on Friday. Reverend Moles Ambrose, the pastor of their church, was with them. The judge told Jefferson that he had been found guilty of the charges brought against him and that the judge saw no reason that he should not pay for the part he played in this horrible crime. Death by electrocution. The governor would set the date. When I came home from school that afternoon, I saw my aunt and Miss Emma sitting at the table in the kitchen. I was sorry now that I had come directly home, because Miss Emma was the last person I wanted to see. Just like everyone else in the quarter, I knew what the sentence was going to be, and I didn't want to have to look into her face. I hurried to my room with the satchel of papers that I had brought from school to work on that night. After laying the satchel on the table that I used as a desk, I sat down on the bed as quietly as I could. I wondered if I could sneak out of the house before my aunt saw me. I got up from the bed, and I was near the door when I heard footsteps in her bedroom. I hurried back to the table and took some papers out of the satchel. When she came into my room, I had sat down at the table and I was pretending to read. My aunt, standing back watching me, knew I was not reading. I pushed the papers away and followed her through her room, back into the kitchen. Miss Emma sat at the kitchen table, staring out into the yard. I started to speak to her, but I wasn't sure that she even knew I was there. "How are you, Miss Emma?"
"Making out," she said.
Miss Emma was in her early or mid-70s. My aunt was in her 70s, and I figured they were pretty much the same age. Miss Emma's hair was gray and combed up and pinned on top. She continued to stare into the yard, but I was sure she was not seeing anything out there. There was nothing out there to see but the jimson weed and crabgrass and the rows of cane that ran parallel to the yard and about 100 feet away from the kitchen where we sat. Miss Emma was not seeing any of that. She was remembering. She was thinking. She was not seeing.
"Called him a hog,"
she said that, and it was quiet again. My aunt looked at me, then back down at the table. I waited. She turned her head slowly and looked directly at me. Her large, dark face showed all the pain she had gone through this day. This past weekend. No, the pain I saw in that face came from many years past.
"I don't want them to kill no hog," she said. "I want a man to go to that chair on his own 2 feet.
I waited, not knowing what was coming. We stared at one another a few seconds before what they expected began to dawn on me. "Wait," I said, "wait." Neither one said a thing until I started to get up and my aunt told me to sit back down.
"He don't have to do it,"
Miss Emma said, looking beyond me again. "Do what?"
"You don't have to do it."
But I could tell by her face and by my aunt's face that they were not about to give up on what they had in mind. "What do you want me to do?" I asked her. "What can I do? It's only a matter of weeks, a couple of months maybe. What can I do that you haven't done the past 21 years?
"You the teacher?"
"Yes, I'm the teacher, and I teach what the white folks around here tell me to teach. Reading, writing, and arithmetic. They never told me how to keep a black boy out of a liquor store."
"You watch your tongue, sir,"
my aunt said. I sat back in the chair and looked at both of them. They sat there like boulders, their bodies, their minds immovable.
"He don't have to,"
Miss Emma said again.
"He gone to do it,"
my aunt said. "Oh?"
"You gone to do it. We going up there and talk to Mr. Henry."
"Talk to Henry Pichot? For what?" I asked her.
"So you have the right to visit Jefferson."
"What's Henry Pichot got to do with this?"
"His brother-in-law is the sheriff, ain't he?"
I waited for her to say more, but she did not. I got up from the table.
"And where do you think you're going?"
Tanner Lou asked me. To Bayonne, where I can breathe. I can't breathe here.
You ain't going to no Bayonne till you go up the quarter,
she said.
You gonna see Mr. Henry with me and Emma there.
I had walked away, but now I came back and leaned over the table toward both of them. Tanner Lou, Miss Emma, Jefferson is dead. It is only a matter of weeks, maybe a couple of months, but he's already dead. The past 21 years, we've done all we could do for Jefferson. He's dead now, and I can't raise the dead. All I can do is try to keep the others from ending up like this. But he's gone from us. There's nothing I can do anymore. Nothing any of us can do anymore.
You going with us up the quarter?
My aunt said, as though I hadn't said a word.
You going with us, Gran. You don't sleep in this house tonight.
I stood back from the table and looked at both of them. I clamped my jaws so tight the veins in my neck felt as if they would burst. I wanted to scream at my aunt. I was screaming inside. I had told her many, many times how much I hated this place and all I wanted was to get away. I had told her I was no teacher. I hated teaching and I was just running in place here. But she had not heard me before, and I knew that no matter how loud I screamed, she would not hear me now.
I'm getting my coat and I'll be ready to go,
she said. My gray 46 Ford stopped at the side gate to Henri Pichot's large white and gray antebellum house. When my aunt started to get out of the car to open the gate for me, I told her to keep her seat because I had nothing to do all day but serve. It was you who said you never wanted me to go through that back door ever again.
Do I have to keep reminding you, Grant, this just ain't another day?
He don't have to go,
Miss Emma said for about the 100th time. She was looking at me but not seeing me and not meaning what she was saying either.
He's going,
my aunt said. She was definitely seeing me.
Mr. Henry won't come to him.
Oh, yes. I keep forgetting that. Mr. Henry won't come to me. After a minute of grunting and straining, they were able to get out of the car. The maid, Inez Lane, had seen us come into the yard, and she opened the door for us. Inez was in her early 40s, I suppose. She wore a white dress, white shoes, a blue gingham apron, and a kerchief on her head. I heard, she said.
I would like to speak to Mr. Henry if he's home,
Miss Emma said. Inez nodded and left us. I looked around the kitchen. I had come into this kitchen many times as a small child to bring in wood for the stove, to bring in the chicken I had caught and killed, eggs I had found in the grass, and figs and pears and pecans I'd gathered from the trees in the yard. Miss Emma was a cook here then. She wore the white dress and the white shoes and the kerchief around her head. She had been here long before I was born, probably when my mother and father were children. She had cooked for the old Pichots, the parents of Henri Pichot. She had cooked for Henri and his brother and sister as well as for his nieces and nephews. He did not have any children of his own. She cooked, ran the house, my aunt washed and ironed, and I ran through the yards to get things they needed to cook or to cook with. I had not come through that back door once since leaving for the university 10 years before. I had been teaching on the place going on 6 years, and I had not been in Pichot's yard, let alone gone up the back stairs or through that back door. Henri Pichot was a medium-sized man of medium weight. He wore a gray suit, a white shirt, and a gray and white striped tie. He could have been in his mid-60s. His hair was white and long. He held a drink.
Mr. Henry,
Miss Emma spoke. My aunt nodded. I didn't. I stood back near the door.
What can I do for you, Emma?
He sure asked her. He seemed annoyed that he had been disturbed while he had company.
I want to ask you a favor, Mr. Henry,
Miss Emma said. He drank from his glass and looked at her.
It's Jefferson.
Yes, I heard, he said, and waited.
I want to ask you a favor.
I can't change what has been handed down by the court. I spoke up before the trial. I can't say any more.
Yes, sir. But that's not what I came to ask you for. I came to ask you for something else.
Miss Emma looked tired. She was tired. She wanted to sit down at the table, but no one had offered her a chair. My aunt put her arm around her shoulders to comfort her and to help her stand.
They call my boy a hog. I didn't raise no hog, and I don't want no hog to go sit in that chair. I want a man to go sit in that chair, Mr. Henry.
He looked at her, but he didn't say anything. He was waiting for his drink.
I need you to speak for me, Mr. Henry. I want the teacher to visit my boy. I want the teacher to make him know that he's not a hog. He's a man. I want him to know that before we go to that chair, Mr. Henry.
Henry Pichot glanced at me, then looked back at her.
I done a lot for this family in this place, Mr. Henry. All I'm asking you to talk to the sheriff for me. I done a lot for this family over the years.
I can't promise anything. He sipped his drink.
You can speak to your brother-in-law.
And say what?
I want the teacher to talk to my boy for me.
He looked over ahead at me, standing back by the door. I was too educated for Henri Pichot. He had no use for me at all anymore. But just as Miss Emma had given so much of herself to that family, so had my aunt. So Henri Pichot, who cared nothing in the world for me, tolerated me because of my aunt. And what do you plan to do? He asked me.
I have no idea.
He stared at me, and I realized that I had not answered him in the proper manner.
Sir, I added.
You think you can change him from a hog into a man in the little time he's got left?
I have no idea, sir.
But you're willing to try, if I can get Mr. Sam to let you go up there.
That's what she wants, sir.
But you didn't put her up to this.
No, sir, I did not.
He was finished talking to me. Now he wanted me to look away. I lowered my eyes. When I raised my head, I saw his eyes on her again. I would forget all this if I were you, he said. Go on home. Forget all this foolishness. You have done all you could to raise him. Let the law have him now.
The law got him, Mr. Henry. And they gonna kill him. But let them kill a man. Let the teacher go to him, Mr. Henry. I done a lot for this family over the years.
And I also know what he did. Or have you forgotten that?
I ain't forgotten nothing, Mr. Henry. I know what they say he did.
He did it.
If you say so, Mr. Henry.
I say so.
That's not what I come up here for, Mr. Henry.
Miss Emma said to him.
I'm not begging for his life no more. That's over. I just want to see him die like a man. This family owe me that much, Mr. Henry. And I want it. I want somebody to do something for me one time before I close my eyes. Somebody got to do something for me one time before I close my eyes, Mr. Henry. Please, sir.
From where I stood back by the door, I could see my aunt tightening her grip around Miss Emma's shoulders to give her comfort. I'll speak to him, Henry said. But it's up to him, not me.
When?
She asked. Henri Pichot had started to raise his glass because for him the conversation was over. But when Miss Emma spoke again, his hand stopped inches from his mouth, and he lowered the glass. What?
When?
Whenever I see him, that's when. Now, if you don't mind, I have a guest. He drank and turned away.
Mr. Henri?
Miss Emma called him, but he kept walking.
I'll be up here again tomorrow, Mr. Henri. I'll be on my knees next time you see me, Mr. Henry.
But she was speaking to empty space. Miss Emma continued to stare up the hall for a moment. Then she and my aunt turned away, and I held the door open for them to go outside. The sun had gone down, and it was getting colder. I took them back down the quarter. Then I turned the car around and started up the quarter again. There was not a single telephone in the quarter, not a public telephone anywhere that I could use before reaching Bayonne. Bayonne was 13 miles away. After leaving the quarter, I drove down a gravel road for about 2 miles, then along a paved road beside the St. Charles River for another 10 miles. There were houses and big live oak and pecan trees on either side of the road, but not as many on the riverbank side. There, instead of houses and trees, there were fishing wharves, boat docks, nightclubs, and restaurants for whites. There were one or two nightclubs for colored, but they were not very good. As I drove along the river, I thought about all the schoolwork that I should have been doing at home. But I knew that after being around Miss Emma and Henri Pichot the past hour, I would not have been able to concentrate on my work. I needed to be with someone. I needed to be with Vivian. Bayonne was a small town of about 6,000, approximately 3,500 whites, approximately 2,500 colored. It was the parish seat for St. Raphael. The courthouse was there, so was the jail. There was a Catholic church uptown for whites, a Catholic church back of town for colored. There was a white movie theater uptown, a colored movie theater back of town. There were two elementary schools uptown, one Catholic, one public for whites, and the same back of town for colored. Bayonne's major industries were a cement plant, a sawmill, and a slaughterhouse, mostly for hogs. There was only one main street in Bayonne, and it ran along the St. Charles River. The department stores, the bank, the two or three dentists and doctors and attorneys' offices were mostly on this street, which made up less than half a dozen blocks. After entering the town, which was marked by the movie theater for whites on the riverbank side of the road, I had to drive another two or three blocks before turning down an unlit road which led back of town to the colored section. Once I crossed the railroad tracks, I could see the Rainbow Club with its green, yellow, and red arch neon lights. Several cars were parked before the door, one of them a big, white, new 48 Cadillac belonging to Joe Claiborne, who owned the place. Thelma Claiborne was behind the counter. Thelma ran the cafe, and her husband Joe ran the bar. I asked her what she had for supper. Smothered chicken, smothered beef steak, shrimp stew, she said. While Thelma dished up my food, I went to the telephone in the corner by the toilet. It took Vivian a while to answer, and she didn't sound too happy about it. Did I get you at a bad time, I asked.
Getting these children something to eat, she said.
Where are you?
The Rainbow Club.
Tonight?
I need to see you, baby. I need to talk.
Is something the matter?
I just need to talk to you, baby. That's all.
I'll see if I can get Dora, she said. If I can't, you'll have to come over here. I can't leave the children alone.
I understand. Car lights had just flashed upon the front of the club, and I could hear the tires on the crushed seashells just right at the door, and sure enough, it was Vivian. And the men at the bar looked around at her when she came in. She was quite tall, 5'7", 5'8", and she wore a green wool sweater and a green and brown plaid skirt, and both fit her very well. She had soft, light brown skin and high cheekbones and greenish-brown eyes, and her nostrils and lips showed some thickness, but not much. Her hair was long and black, and she kept it twisted into a bun and pinned at the back of her head. Vivian Baptiste was a beautiful woman, and she knew it, but she didn't flaunt it. It was just there. She came up to me, and a couple of the other men at the bar nodded and spoke to her. One tipped his hat and called her Miss Lady. Vivian and I went to a table far into the corner where we could be alone. I'm glad you came. I kissed her. When was the last time I told you I loved you?
A second ago.
I should say it more often, I said.
What is the matter, Grant?
You want to leave from here tonight? I asked her. You want to go home and pack your clothes and get the children and leave from here tonight? She looked at me as though she was trying to figure out whether I was serious or not.
No,
she said. Why not?
Because the whole thing is just too crazy.
People do it all the time, just pack up and leave.
Some people can, but we can't, she said. We're teachers, and we have a commitment.
You hit the nail on the head there, lady. Commitment. Commitment to what? To live and die in this hellhole when we can leave and live like other people?
How much have you had to drink, Grant?
A whole fucking barrel of commitment, I said, and raised my glass.
Do you want me to leave, Grant? You know I don't like it when you talk like that.
No, I don't want you to leave. Please, don't leave me.
She reached over and touched my hand. Then she began to rub the knuckles with her fingers.
I need to go someplace where I can feel like I'm living, I said. I don't want to spend the rest of my life teaching school in a plantation church. I want to be with you someplace where we could have a choice of things to do. I don't feel alive here. I'm not living here. I know we can do better someplace else.
I'm still married, Vivian said. A separation is not a divorce. I can't go anywhere until this is all over with.
That's not what's keeping you here. Even after the divorce, you'll still feel committed.
And you, Grant?
I'm tired of feeling committed.
Then why haven't you gone?
Because of you.
That's not true, Grant, and you know it, she said.
We met only 3 years ago.
I was still married, pregnant with my second child.
You told me then how much you always wanted to get away, and you did once. You remember that? You went to California to visit your mother and father, but you wouldn't stay. You couldn't stay. You had to come back.
Why did you come back, Grant?
Why? I want to go now, and I want you to go with me.
I'm still married, Grant.
After the divorce?
She nodded.
A couple from one of the other tables had gotten up and chosen a record on the jukebox. It was a blues, the tempo slow, and the two people danced close together. I needed Vivian closer to me than she was now, and I asked her if she wanted to dance. We left the table, and I took her in my arms, and I could feel her breasts through that sweater, and I could feel her thighs through that plaid skirt, and now I felt very good. We danced for a while. I didn't want to say it. I had to say it. They gave him death. I could feel her body go tense against me. We danced a while. They want me to visit him.
That would be nice.
They want me to make him a man before he dies. She stopped dancing, and she stood back to look at me. Her face was twisted into a painful, questioning frown. The record ended, and we went back to our table. What do I say to him? Do I know what a man is? Do I know how a man is supposed to die? I'm still trying to find out how a man should live. Am I supposed to tell someone how to die who has never lived? Vivian lowered her head. Suppose I was allowed to visit him, and suppose I reached him and made him realize that he was as much a man as any other man. Then what? He's still going to die. The next day, the next week, the next month. So what will I have accomplished? What will I have done? Why not let the hog die without knowing anything? Vivian raised her head to look at me, and she was crying. I took one of her hands in both of mine. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to do this to you. I don't want to do this to you. I just didn't know where else to turn.
I want you to come to me, Grant, she said. I want you to always come to me. If they say yes, I want you to go for me.
For you?
For us, Grant.
I looked at her, and she looked back at me. She had meant what she said. I don't know if I can take it. I really don't.
I know you can.
I'll need you every moment.
I'll be there.
Vivian raised her glass to me and smiled. You have the most beautiful smile, I said. She smiled again. What are you doing this weekend? I asked her. We had friends in Baton Rouge who knew about her pending divorce and knew about my aunt, and they let us stay for a while at their place while they went out to visit a bar. Sometimes we would join them at the bar later. Other times, we would just leave the key in an envelope with a thank you note. But we were both getting very tired of that. My classroom was the church. My classes ranged from the primer to the sixth grade.
My pupils from 6 years old to 13 and 14. My desk was a table used as a collection table by the church on Sundays and also used for the service of the Holy Sacrament on the fourth Sunday of each month. My students' desks were the benches upon which their parents and grandparents sat during the church meetings. The students either got down on their knees and used the benches as desks to write upon, or used the backs of their books upon their laps to write out their assignments. Our heat came from a wood-burning stove in the center of the church. There was a blackboard on the back wall and another on the right side wall. Behind my desk was the pulpit and the altar. This was my school. I was supposed to teach 6 months out of the year, but actually I taught only 5.5 months, from late October to the middle of April, when the children were not needed in the field. Only by assigning the upper grade students to teach the lower grades was it possible to reach all the students every day. I devoted the last 2 hours in the afternoon to the fifth and sixth grades. The third grade class would do arithmetic on the board on the back wall, and the fourth graders would write sentences on the board on the right side wall. I moved from one blackboard to the other with my yard-long Westcott ruler. Every little thing was irritating me. I caught one of the students trying to figure out a simple multiplication problem on his fingers, and I slashed him hard across the butt with the Westcott ruler. He jerked around too fast and looked at me too angrily for my liking. "Your hand," I said. He held out his right hand, palm up. He still held a piece of chalk. "You used enough chalk for 5 times that many problems," I told him. "Where do you think we're going to get more chalk when this runs out?" He didn't answer. "Well, I don't know, Mr. Wiggins," he said, staring at the board, not daring to look at me. "I'd have to buy it. The school board doesn't give it away. They already gave me what they said was enough for the year. They're not giving us any more. Do you understand what I'm saying to you?"
"Yes, sir, Mr. Wiggins."
I jerked the piece of chalk out his hand, corrected the problem, passed the piece of chalk on to another student, and walked away. "Do you all know what is going on in Bayonne?" I asked him back at my desk. "Do you all know what is going to happen to someone just like you who sat right where you're sitting only a few years ago? All right, I'll tell you. They're going to kill him in Bayonne. They're going to sit him in a chair. They're going to tie him down with straps. They're going to connect wires to his head, to his wrists, to his legs. And they're going to shoot electricity through the wires into his body until he's dead." I looked across the room at them. Some stared back at me, others down at the floor, but they were all listening. They knew Jefferson was supposed to die in the electric chair, but they hadn't known how this would happen. It had not been explained to them so vividly before, and maybe not at all. I could see how painful it was for most of them to hear this, but I did not stop. "Do you know what his nan-nan wants me to do before they kill him? The public defender called him a hog, and she wants me to make him a man within the next few weeks, maybe a month. Whatever the law allows, make him a man. Exactly what I'm trying to do here with you now, to make you responsible young men and young ladies. But you refuse to study your arithmetic, and you prefer writing slanted sentences instead of straight ones. Does that make any sense?" "Well, does it?" No one answered. Most averted their eyes. We heard a knocking at the door. Pharrell Giroux was a small, light brown man in his 50s. He was the yardman and all-around handyman for Henri Pichot. He fixed and sharpened tools for the big house, and he served as carpenter for the people in the quarter. He had made more benches, fixed more chairs and steps than you could number. He took off his hat as I approached him. He had known me all my life, and he knew my aunt and all my people before me. But since I had gone off to the university and returned as a teacher, he treated me with great respect. I went down the steps and into the yard.
"Professor?"
"Mr. Farrell?" "Is this about Jefferson?" I asked. "He didn't tell me. Just say it'd be all right if you come there about 5.
"Thank you, Mr. Farrell."
"My pleasure, Professor." He put on his hat and I noticed his eyes. He knew why Henri Pichot wanted me up there all right. But Henri Pichot had not thought it was necessary to tell him. At his age,
he was still only a messenger to run errands. To learn anything, he had to attain it by stealth, or through an innate sense of things around him. He nodded to me, knowing that I knew why Henri Pichot wanted to see me, and he walked away, head down. Inez was in the kitchen when I came up the back stairs.
How are you, Inez?
I'm making out,
she said, not looking at me. You know why he sent for me?
Mr. Sam coming here at 5.
I glanced at my watch. It was 5:10.
Can I get you a cup of coffee?
Inez asked. No, thanks.
You want to sit down?
She still did not look at me. I'm all right. I don't mind standing.
I remembered how my aunt and Miss Emma had stood the night before. At 5:30, we heard people entering the house off the front gallery. Inez left the kitchen to meet them. She spoke to Edna Guidry, then to Sam Guidry, and to one or two other people. I could hear them talking as they came into the house. At 6:00, Inez dished up the food and took the platters and bowls to the dining room.
Can I fix you something?
She asked me when she came back to the kitchen. No, thank you, I told her. I was hungry. I hadn't eaten anything but a sandwich since breakfast, but I would not eat at Henri Pichot's kitchen table. I had come through that back door against my will, and it seemed that he and the sheriff were doing everything they could to humiliate me even more by making me wait on them. Well, I had to put up with that because of those in the quarter, but I damn sure would not add hurt to injury by eating at his kitchen table. Inez went to the dining room and came back.
They talking up there now about him, she said. Sheriff saying he don't like the idea at all, saying nobody can make that thing a man, saying might as well let him go like he is.
I hope that's his final word. It sure would relieve my mind.
Why don't you sit down? You'll feel better.
I'd rather stand.
He asked me if you were still here, she said.
I think he gonna let you see him, but he say he's still against it. I'm sure it's Miss Edna making him do it.
Well, all the time Miss Emma done spent with this family, that ain't asking too much. At 7:15, Inez cleared off the table in the dining room and brought the dishes into the kitchen. Then she took a bottle of brandy back with her. A half hour later, while she was putting away the dishes she had just finished washing, Sam Guidry and Henri Pichot came into the kitchen. I had been standing there nearly 2.5 hours. Sam Guidry was a tall man, well over 6 feet, and he was well tanned. His hair was dark brown, his sideburns and mustache showed some gray. His face was narrow, well lined and strong. His hands were large and hairy. He wore a brown suit and tie. He usually wore a Stetson hat and cowboy boots. He had probably left the hat in the library or in the dining room, but he had the boots on. Inez left the kitchen as soon as the white men came in. I tried to decide just how I should respond to them, whether I should act like the teacher I was or like the nigger I was supposed to be. I decided to wait and see how the conversation went. To show too much intelligence would have been an insult to them. To show a lack of intelligence would have been a greater insult to me.
Been waiting long?
Sam Guidry asked me.
About 2.5 hours, sir, I said.
I was supposed to say not long, and I was supposed to grin, but I didn't do either. I could see in their faces that they had talked all this over, and Sam Guidry had already made up his mind what he was going to do.
What can I do for you?
He asked.
It's about Jefferson, Sheriff Guidry, I said. I knew they had discussed it. Still, I had to go through the motions.
His Nan-Nan would like for me to visit him.
What for?
Guidry asked.
They had discussed this, too.
She's old, I said.
She doesn't feel that she has the strength to come up there all the time.
She doesn't, huh?
Sam Guidry asked me. He emphasized doesn't. I was supposed to have said don't. I was being too smart.
I hear from people around here you want to make him a man. A man for what at this time?
She asked me to go to him, sir. Her idea, not mine.
That was not the question,
Guidry said.
Make him a man for what?
to die with some dignity, I suppose. I suppose that's what she wants.
You think that's a good idea?
That's what she wants, sir.
What do you think?
I would rather not have anything to do with it, sir. But that's what she wants.
So you think he ought to just go like he is?
I don't know how he is, sir. Believe me, Mr. Guidry, if it was left up to me, I wouldn't have anything to do with it at all, I said.
You and I are in accord there. But my wife thinks different. Now, which one you think is right? Me or her?
I never get into family business, Mr. Guidry.
You're smart,
Guidry said.
Maybe you're just a little too smart for your own good.
I was quiet. I knew when to be quiet.
I don't like it. And I want you to know I don't like it. Because I think the only thing you can do is just aggravate him, trying to put something in his head against his will. And I'd rather see a contented hog go to that chair than an aggravated hog. It would be better for everybody concerned. There ain't a thing you can put in that skull that ain't there already.
I remained quiet.
You can come up there, but the first sign of aggravation, I'm calling it off. You understand?
Yes, sir.
You have any questions?
Yes, sir. When can I see him?
You can come any time you like. Not before 10 in the morning, not after 4 in the evening. Any other questions?
Any idea how much time he has left?
That's entirely up to the governor, not me,
Guidry said.
But I wouldn't plan on a diploma, okay?
Thank you, sir. I waited until they had left the kitchen. Then I went out to my car and drove away.